No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. We're very excited about our guest tonight, but let me first say hello to my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are you?
I'm terrific, and I'm sorry to be the victor, and my condolences to the loss that the Washington football team experienced at the hands of the Los Angeles Rams.
I think that's a little snotty there, Maria. I think you're really, I don't think you're sincere, but, you know, all I would say to the Los Angeles Rams is everybody's beaten the Washington team, so why should
you
be any different?
Terrible record, huh? 1-4 now,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
One and four, I think we are now.
Yeah.
We won one game. We beat Philadelphia, our arch rival. But anyway, it's great to hear your voice, and it's great tonight that we have with us Professor Alan Sanders. Professor Sanders is a former Time magazine reporter and a professor emeritus at St. Peter's University in New Jersey, my home state. He is often called upon by major TV, radio, and radio stations to discuss legislation, political, and international developments. He went to Princeton. He graduated from Columbia Law. As they say, he's got it all going on. So thanks so much for being with us tonight, Professor.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
We appreciate your time. I was going to say, if you don't mind, Michael, that because the vice presidential debate was this week and the presidential debate the week prior, that was one of the reasons that we wanted to invite Mr. Sanders onto the program to talk about that from more of a bipartisan perspective than, because Michael and I try, even though we're from different political persuasions, we try and be respectful, courteous, and allow one another the opportunity to speak uninterrupted. Could you give us your take on what you think went down this week with the vice presidential debate, please?
Well, for the vice presidential debate, I think it really didn't change the trajectory of the campaign. Most of the pundits say that Senator Harris won that debate. But in terms of affecting the presidential race, I don't think it made much of a difference, largely because it was what I would call a normal debate. That is to say, both candidates stated their positions on the key issues. But there was no great fireworks that emanated from that. And it was quickly overtaken by the news developments of the week. And of course, the big news development, the one that people were focusing on, was the health of the president and all the issues that surround that. So I think from the Biden campaign, this was a success. That is to say, they didn't want to create any sparks, any moment that would have upset what they perceive as their commanding positions right now in the various states. For the Trump campaign, I suppose it was a bit of a disappointment because nothing happened that really changed the dynamics. So it was a draw. But in terms of what it means, generally speaking, it probably wound up being a win for the Biden campaign at this point in time.
Yeah, I think that, you know, my position going into the debate was that Kamala Harris, what she needed to do was not mess up. You know, it's like, to use a football analogy, despite my colleague's snarky remarks. It was the fourth quarter. She's the second string quarterback. Just get in the game and don't fumble the ball. And I think she kind of did that. But let me ask you, what do you think of the way this campaign is going, that the pundits are out saying that the president needs to convince suburban women to come over to his side, and he's really not, it really seems like he's not going after that group?
Well, that's right. The president's strategy from the get-go has always been to solidify his base, to activate his base, and to hope, but also plan, that will be enough to get him over the top. It did work in 2016 because the base at that point was broader than the base, so to speak. That is to say, there were a lot of people who felt that they had been shortchanged over the years economically and socially, and they felt that Washington needed to be shaken up. And so the base at that time was a broader array of people. And even so, by the way, it wasn't really a majority of the American people, because we know that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote.
Right.
Right now, a lot of people who were part originally of the coalition of Trump supporters, many of them are drifting away. And you mentioned suburbanites, particularly suburban women. Also, senior citizens now are a little more doubtful about the Trump campaign because of the president's handling of the pandemic. And of course, the minority constituencies have never been in favor of President Trump. And now, of course, they're more activated than ever in trying to deny him a second term because of the insults and because of the way the president has, through his rhetoric, has slammed various constituencies, particularly minority constituencies. So the president is in a deficit right now. His plan has been, and consistently, to really try to energize his base. But my feeling is that his base is narrower right now than it was back in 2016, because that base back then, as I say, included people who felt that they had been shortchanged and they wanted to see a shakeup. Now that we've had the shakeup, I think some people are drifting away from that.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think that he is out there motivating Democrats as well as he's motivating his own base. And let me just ask you, before I let Marie ask another question, I've been involved in many presidential campaigns. There must be, I know that you teach courses on American politics and the presidency, there must be people behind this man saying to him, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't blame Gold Star mothers. Don't blame the mothers of dead soldiers for your coronavirus. Don't go out on the balcony. Don't have another rally. What do you think of that? Do you think the professionals behind him, or he just ignores them?
Well, I think there are two factors. I think one is, yes, I think in part he does ignore them. He's always had a lot of confidence in his gut instincts and what he believes works. So I think in large measure, he is ignoring some advice. But on the other hand, understand that he is the president of the United States. And like any president, it's very difficult for staffers, whether they are officials of the government or whether they are campaign staffers, it's very difficult to tell the president you're wrong. The presidency right. carries a certain aura, and whether it's Trump or whether it's Obama or whether it's Clinton or Ronald Reagan or anybody, it's hard to tell the president, sorry, sir, I think you're wrong. And that's part of the problem for any president.
Right. They say that about success. I've heard that, you know, regardless of what industry you're in, and obviously the highest office in our nation would have the aura that you refer to, but success changes the people around you, and they do become more like sycophants, like you're saying, is that no one wants to say no to him, which is a shame, because I would think that you would want to surround yourself with truth tellers. Like, who's not telling him that he's looking orange?
That's a good question.
I mean, Ivanka surely has more sense than that, and he's looking more orange now than when he did before he went into the hospital. I mean, I'm just stupefied that somebody would, should have his ear. Forget the tweet storms. You know, obviously that's something that he's going to do, whether someone takes his phone away from him or not, which I also think they should do, like a toddler, you know, get a timeout from your phone when you're tweeting. But what I don't understand is why you wouldn't want the naysayers around you too. So you have a reality check.
Yeah, I mean, that usually is, you know, what political scientists will say. You need certainly people who are supportive of you. But one of the greatest elements of loyalty is to tell the president when you honestly think that he's wrong, or the policies he is pursuing, or the strategy that he is pursuing doesn't work. That's loyalty. If you tell the president, look, I don't think it's working. But this president has not been very tolerant of dissent. We know that. We know that he has imposed a line of thinking. That thinking varies from day to day, by the way. But whatever the line of thinking is on a particular day, we know that this president does not like people to say contrary statements or present contrary points of view. He's proven to be rather vindictive. We know that in campaigns past, where there have been candidates that have criticized him, even mildly, and he will come down very hard on them and campaign very actively against them. So one can only imagine what it must be within the confines of the West Wing.
And I'm
Let me
curious
ask you.
About, oh, you go ahead,
go
Michael.
Ahead. No, go ahead, Marie.
I had a letter to the editor published early this week about the presidential debate and then the vice presidential debate, because of the influence that we have technologically, that when the person who doesn't have the floor, why their mic isn't turned off, when the candidate who speaks longer than 2 minutes, why their mic isn't turned off, why don't we put them, especially the president and the vice president Biden, in soundproof booths where they can see and hear one another, but we don't hear from them until they're called upon. Why they don't answer the question that they're asked. Why aren't we doing something about that? Because everybody's breaking the rules.
Yeah, well, I think the fundamental reason why it doesn't happen is because the candidates have to agree to the rules. Now, they may choose to break them, as we've seen in these past two debates, in order to get them to participate, there is no law, there is no constitutional clause that requires presidential candidates to debate. So although we have this commission, the commission can only ask the candidates to come and debate. And then the candidates have a huge say in what the rules will be. And of course, ultimately, they decide on the spot whether they're actually going to follow the rules that they agreed to. My view is that maybe the best way to go, since you can't force them to abide by any rules, even the ones they agree, perhaps it might just be better to give each candidate a certain amount of time to simply speak to the American people about whatever they want to say. Mm. You know, a half hour, an hour, whatever might seem reasonable over a stretch of time. So you give the Republican candidate the X minute of airtime to say what he wants. You give the Democratic candidate whatever he wants to say, again, X minute of airtime. And that eliminates the need for a moderator for questions, and people can judge these statements by the candidates on their own. Some candidates will choose to argue the issues as they see them. Some will try to evade the issues, but at least there are no rules, and the only rule is you've got X minute of time. Say whatever you want to say.
I like that.
You know, yeah, I like it too. I think it's a great idea. Let me move for a second to something you said earlier about Trump capitalizing on this coalition of people who felt like they've been left out and ignored. Do you think that Democrats have fully grasped this? Because I think sometimes, as a Democrat, I don't think the Democrats fully get that people, you know, that there's a large constituency out there of millions of people who feel like the Democratic Party has forgotten them. Do you think we've heard that message?
Well, no, I think major elements of the Democratic Party still have not heard that message, but I do think that Joe Biden has heard that message. And yeah, I think there have been enough people within that Democratic coalition that ultimately wound up voting for him who have heard that message. You know, the Democratic Party, like any party, is made up of a coalition of people. And so we always hear in the press about the liberal base of the Democratic Party. Well, that's true, but it is only a base. There's also a large moderate base to the Democratic Party, moderate liberal base to the Democratic Party. And I think Joe Biden has demonstrated in the way he's campaigned and in the way he has spoken that he hears the liberal base. He understands their point of view, but he comes from that moderate base of the Democratic Party. And he can speak to that base because he comes from that politically and personally. What's interesting about his candidacy, and we see that, you know, Donald Trump from way back when, including, you know, the whole Ukraine issue that cropped up, Trump understood that from the very beginning. And that's why he targeted Joe Biden from the very beginning with the Ukraine business that we went through for months. And just simply in his statements, he's tried to paint Joe Biden in so many different ways. But ultimately, what he finds most dangerous to his campaign is the fact that Joe Biden speaks from that moderate base. There are really two bases in the Democratic Party. And Biden speaks for that moderate base, which I think is still the larger segment, but there is that liberal base. And so one thing to watch for, however the election comes out, is that fight between those two elements of the Democratic Party. You will see that if Joe Biden wins the election. You will see both sides trying to make the case and to try to push Biden one way or the other. You will also see that if Biden loses. That is to say, you know, the two bases will try to blame each other, or inevitably that's what happened. You sort of blame the other the other side of your argument for whatever losses are suffered. So there are these two bases, and whether Biden wins or loses, I think you'll see both of those bases contend with each other.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And certainly, I've seen it a lot in the Democratic Party that there's some people that, you know, I think our Achilles heel is that we tend to talk down to the other side. Liberals do. You know, we say, you don't really want a gun. You just don't understand why you don't want a gun, and we're going to explain it to you. So right. I think it's been a problem for us over time.
I agree with you. I mean, when you think back, you know, Franklin Roosevelt is sort of the archetypical Democrat. He made sure that he spoke directly to the working class, the class that he felt was most in need of help economically and downtrodden and put down. And so he spoke directly to that element of the Democratic Party. But he also made sure that he spoke to the sort of elite, the intellectual branch of the party. And that was the key to his success, to be able to speak to both parts of the base. Biden, I think, has that potential. It seems to be working right now. But, you know, we'll have to see whether it's ultimately successful on November the 3rd.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that Obama had that quality, too, that he could speak very intellectually without talking down to people. You know, I grew up in the Democratic Party, and I was used to more of the kind of Southern Baptist minister kind of, you know, person that spoke with, like Dr. King did, with a lot of fire and a lot of emotion. And I always felt that Obama spoke more intellectually, but he never talked down to people. I think that was a great asset that he had. Maria?
Yeah, I was going to ask, Professor, you've had such a varied and multifaceted career. And if our listeners are coming in later and you didn't hear in the introduction, you got your bachelor's degree from Princeton, and then you went on to get your law degree from Columbia University, and then you were with Time Magazine for 20 years, and then you became a political science professor, and you're also now a guest on programs and all. How did you feel that your Columbia Law School education informed your career choices and how you executed them?
Well, you know, one of the things that legal education tries to instill in its students is the ability to look at facts and look at principles. For lawyers, it's principles of law, and to try to sift through. That is to say, try to get to the heart of the matter. That's what, you know, thinking of a lawyer is all about. Get to the heart of the matter and understand what is the fluff around it or the subsidiary arguments. And so a legal education is certainly critical for a lawyer to be able to get down to the nitty gritty of what's really at stake here and what are the subsidiary arguments. And that's true for a journalist as well. In fact, you will find that I'm no exception. There are a lot of journalists out there who are lawyers. A good journalist tries to get down to the actual nub of the story, the facts, the central elements. Then there are these concentric circles, you know, around those facts and subsidiary arguments and subsidiary lines of inquiry. And it's important to be able to differentiate the two. Also important to be able to differentiate that when you're talking to a politician, any government official. What is the actual policy or what is the actual goal that the politician or the government official is trying to achieve? And then what are the subsidiary arguments? Some of the subsidiary arguments are valid. Some are just there to sort of throw you off course and to send you in the wrong direction. Being a lawyer and being able to differentiate that is critical. So journalism simply really clearly fits in that within those parameters. Same thing for a professor. You really want your students to focus on what's at stake, what is really going on, what have you really learned, what's the real point that any reading you're asked to read for a course is trying to get through to you, and what are the subsidiary arguments, what's the analysis that you're going to provide to the professor. And as you grade papers, I behave like a lawyer. I mean, you know, sometimes students would tell me stuff, and I put down in the margin, really? You really believe that? Really? Or are you aware of where this argument that you're providing me with is going to take you ultimately? Do you believe, you know, where it's going to wind up if you take this argument to its end point? So lawyering, the ability to be able to sift through information and to separate out the relevant from the irrelevant and to understand those differences is critical for law, but I think it's also very important for journalism and for being a professor.
And speaking of the law, I was just going to follow that up with tomorrow starts the Amy Coney Barrett Supreme Court process. What are your thoughts about how that's going to unfold, including she just said within the last hour that she intends to apply the law as written?
Yeah, well, you know, as a lawyer, I have to tell you that's just nonsense. Okay, any lawyer or any Supreme Court appointee or any judge who tells you that is just spewing nonsense. There's no such thing as interpreting the law as it is written. Laws, constitutional clauses, have a history behind them. They have policy goals behind them. And everyone who has voted for a law, or even the framers who created our Constitution, there were different motives going on. So to say the law as written, what was the motive of the framers? Many of them, had different motives. They agreed on a particular clause, but they had different interpretations of that clause. And therefore, to say, you know, just interpret the law as written makes absolutely no sense. Every judge, every lawyer, every politician, every framer of a constitution comes to the documents that they're going to produce or the laws they're going to write or the opinions they're going to write with a point of view. Nothing is neutral in this world. Everybody has a set of values. And therefore, to say I'm going to interpret the law as written makes absolutely no sense. What's the concept of equality? Okay, we have lots of clauses in the Constitution that speak about equality. What equality are we talking about? Are we talking about racial equality? Are we talking about religious equality? Are we talking about economic equality? Are we talking about what are we talking about? So you bring to that word equality certain values, and to say, well, I'm just going to interpret the law or the Constitution according to its words. Tell me what equality means. And once you start doing that, you're in the basis of personal point of view and on the basis of personal interpretation and judicial interpretation. So those are patent. Those are words that are generally spoken to sort of get by and not really explain their views. There is no such thing as I'm going to interpret the law as written, because as it is written, every word is subject to a person's different interpretation of that word.
Wow.
Well, you know, there's no clear example of that than what we suffer here in the District of Columbia, that we don't have the same rights that everybody else has, and there's a different agenda for that depending on who you're talking about. The Republicans don't want D.C. to be a state because they don't want two more Democrats. So really, that's exactly what you're saying is right. And let me ask you, given that what you just said about your interpretation and how you view things through the lens of your experience and your education, what do you think we've lost now that we, you know, instead of reading Time magazine, we go on the internet and anybody with a political opinion has a voice? Do you think we've lost a lot by having all these people that really don't have the experience and the education to speak on politics, who speak on politics? Rush Limbaugh, for example.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very complicated subject, and lots of people have different points of view on it. Certainly, it's like anything, you know, it's like any development, any new technology, any new scientific discovery, any new concept. It's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it is absolutely wonderful that people have access to the internet, and that they can speak freely about whatever they want to speak about and air whatever points of view they have. On the other hand, we know that that allows for a lot of falsehood, a lot of crazy conspiracy theories, and a lot of disinformation, both from ordinary citizens, but also from foreign countries and enemies of the United States. So it's a real problem. I'm not sure what the exact solution to that is, but I would say one of the problems is that the internet providers have been treated under the law as basically as utilities, as, kind of like the sidewalk, the general sidewalk. On a sidewalk, people can say whatever they want, and it's a sidewalk. It's sort of a channel of communication. I would be more inclined personally to treat the internet and certainly the social media platforms not as public sidewalks where people can sort of speak what they want, but rather as publishers, like a newspaper or like a television station. A newspaper has letters to the editors that it publishes, so people can air their views on those platforms, letters to the editors. But ultimately, the newspaper is responsible for anything that's libelous or that is likely to cause harm on the basis of what's stated in those sections on letters to the editors. I think it would be important to explore. I mean, I haven't explored all the possible ramifications of this, but as a general principle, I think social media, certainly, and possibly the internet, but certainly social media, should be looked at more as a publisher of information rather than as a common carrier of information.
And so who bears the responsibility there? The internet provider? Does the Facebook, is Facebook and Instagram and these guys responsible for, you would hold them responsible for content?
Sure. I think you can hold both the speaker, the actual speaker, for libelous content or content that is likely to cause imminent danger of lawbreaking, violence, and the internet provider as well, both. Because they are, I mean, you know, there's constitutional law about inciting violence. The standards are pretty specific and pretty well laid out. But if a website, social message is inciting violence, you can sue the actual speaker, but you could also sue the publisher under general law. But the internet is protected. There is a statute, and I don't have it in front of me, but when the internet was born, there was a general interest in letting it grow. It was sort of a new, novel thing. We weren't sure where it was going to go, how it was going to evolve. And so there's a protective statute there that limits the instances when you can actually sue the internet provider. It would be worth taking a look at that and seeing whether that protective statute should be amended.
Well, it just happened today that Twitter added a warning letter, claimed that he's immune to the coronavirus, and then Facebook did nothing about it.
Yeah, you're cut off a little bit from when you were speaking, so I'm not sure I heard everything, but you said that something that the president from the coronavirus. Hello? Are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
And Twitter didn't do anything about it? Is that what you were saying to me? Go ahead.
Twitter flagged the tweet from President Trump that said he's immune from the coronavirus, but Facebook didn't do anything about that same statement.
Right.
So it is hit and miss with them, and they aren't regulated. And I'm not a big one about that, but you're right. They're media, and I think they should fall under the FCC, frankly.
Yeah, well, the FCC is it's a little different. That's because the FCC also tries not to police content. It's not perfect about that, but at least it strives not to police content. I think personally, I think the better way to go. But again, I haven't thought through all the ramifications. But as a general idea, the better way to go is to allow people to sue, because after all, money is what really determines what these corporations do. It's what determines what all corporations do. But any media corporation is ultimately interested in making money. And the way it makes money is by attracting listeners, viewers, an audience of some kind. It might be useful to see whether these companies should be open to suit by people who believe they have been damaged. The typical damage is libel, that is to say, a hurt to reputation. But some of these statements from some of these people are actually inciting violence. That's another thing that you could sue a media provider for doing, which is conveying an incitement to violence. Again, it needs to be looked at a little bit more closely, but I think a good way to police is simply to make these companies accountable with the bottom line, their profits.
Well, it seems to me like you have several good ideas, Professor. So let me ask you, what's going to happen? What do you think America looks like on November 4th? What does it look like? It seems to be that no matter which candidate wins, and I'm a Biden supporter, I was a superdelegate for Biden, but it seems to me that no matter which candidate wins, the country's going to become even more divided over this race. Do you think that's the case? Do you think we can come back together?
It depends on two things. A, it depends on who wins. And number two, it depends on the margin of victory for that candidate. Certainly if the results...
And how so?
Sorry. Pardon?
We're having just a little technical... I'm sorry. I asked, how is that so?
Okay.
What makes you say that?
Right. Well, we know, for instance, that Donald Trump has waged his campaign in a way that has divided America. That's the way he's conducted his presidency. We are far more divided today than we were at the outset of his presidency. So whatever he might say, it's quite a fact that we were divided under Obama. There's no question about that. But I think if you take a look at the way people are reacting to each other today politically, it's a far more divisive country than it was at the outset of his presidency. He can't deny that. So if he wins re-election and he continues on the path that he has set for the first 4 years, if he continues on that path in the second 4 years, I don't see how this country is going to come much closer together, because it hasn't. It hasn't under his watch in the first 4 years. Biden makes the assertion that he's going to be all embracing. Now, we'll have to see whether that's true. Okay, I can't foresee the future. But at least he's running a campaign in which he's trying to bring more people together. His appeal is not so much to the one of the bases of the Democratic Party, as we were talking about before. His appeal, he's trying to embrace both bases of the Democratic Party, and then reaching out further and asking Republicans to join him as well, and arguing that if he is going to be elected president, he will be president of the United States, not president of the Democratic Party. That's what he's saying. Okay. Now, if he carries through on that, that has some potential for trying to bring us together afterwards, if he does carry it through. But his ability to do that, whether he intends to do it or not, his ability to do that will also depend in large measure on the margin of his victory. That is to say, if he just squeaks by and wins the presidency, Well, he can try to do that, but he's going to be facing a very divided country. And so his ability to do that will be difficult. If, on the other hand, he wins by a large majority, whether it's a large majority of the popular vote or a large majority of the Electoral College, he can claim a resounding victory, a mandate of some kind, and therefore he will have an easier time to try and bring the country back together. So it's really a factor of who wins based on what they're saying. And then secondly, what is the size of the mandate? What is the size of the victory?
I wanted to put into perspective what you said back about Amy Barrett and the comment she made about applying the law as written. And another quote she said is, whatever my own preferences might be, she will judge legal cases impartially. And yet you say that we can't help but bring our opinions into the room, if you will. And as a therapist, when I have clients and they say something to me, I'll say to them, I know what that means to me, but I don't know what that means to you. Could you give me your frame of reference? And you gave the example about equality, because that means different things to different people. Are those fair questions for them to ask of her? Because before they said, you know, her faith shouldn't come into it. Well, her faith does inform her. Now, I'm a practicing Roman Catholic, so I should make that clear, too. So, but I hear what you're saying, and I don't think I've ever thought of it in that way, because I have opinions, but I, especially when I'm in therapy and doing therapy, I try to leave those at the door because it's not my life. And as long as seniors, children, and animals aren't being harmed, it's really not my place to say what's wrong and what's right.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's a delicate issue, but if we can split it apart intellectually, it's not so difficult to understand. I think it is wrong to question somebody's religious faith or religious views. Everybody is entitled to that. But it is not wrong to question someone's statement about what they believe is right or wrong, which may have been informed by their religious views. So you don't attack the person's religious views. That's a matter of between that person and the Almighty. But you can attack a point of view that has been stated by someone informed by his or her religious views or informed by anything else. So, for instance, there are certain statements that Judge Barrett has made on abortion. There are certain statements that she's made on the Affordable Care Act. There are such statements that she has made on a whole host of issues. So you question that. What do you mean? You are on record having said this about Roe versus Wade. What does that mean about your belief in that decision? You've been quoted as saying that this or that about the Affordable Care Act. What does that mean? What is your point of view? What would you bring to it? So I think you've got to make, I mean, it's kind of easy to understand that intellectually. And I think there's a difference here, a quite clear difference intellectually. But when you're in the heat of a debate and when you're asking a question, and in the back and forth of, you know, a committee hearing, that may get confused and may get misunderstood. So it's a careful balancing act in the questioning, but intellectually, it's clear to me that there is a difference.
For that, I think that should help everybody as we approach these 4 days starting tomorrow with what's going to be happening.
Yeah.
So he may be gone. So that's one of the reasons. Yes,
that I hope we're having him away.
Yeah, no, Alan. Thanks for your time, by the way, and your perspective and your wisdom. Because I don't think I've ever thought of it in that regard. Because I think, you know, when you put on that robe and you sit behind that bench, you are omnipotent, right? You're higher than whatever petty things that human foibles dictate. But I guess you're right. We can only help but bring our humanity to the room because that's what we are, human beings.
Right. There's a very famous essay written by Judge Cardozo, ultimately Justice Cardozo, Benjamin Cardozo, in which he talks about the art of judging And it's quite an interesting article, and I would urge your listeners to look it up. And he really talks about that. You know, how do I decide a case? And he was quite forthright. And he said, well, you know, yes, I try to apply the law. I try to apply precedents. I try to be fair to both sides. But ultimately, I bring to the task of judging. And it was quite a frank statement by the judge, okay? And it was at a time when we weren't so politicized. And he says, but ultimately, I bring my life experience. I bring my values. I bring my humanity to judging what I believe is fair. And that's what you can expect of a judge, to bring their humanity. And their humanity is the whole total of their life experience, their training, yes, their religion, but also the trials and tribulations that they have faced as they have gone through life. And that's the best any judge can do. So it's fair to ask a judge about what have been your trials and tribulations, what are your values, what really is most important, which part of the Constitution do you believe is most reflective of what needs to be done when you engage in judging, things like that. And I think you get a sense of what the judge will do, who she will, you know, how she will address the issues.
And we had lost the senator, but he's back.
I'm back, and I apologize. I'm on a cell phone in Myrtle Beach, so it's a little. I had a little technical difficulty. Professor, let me ask you a process question. Do you think they have enough time to do a confirmation at this point? You've got several. I think at last count, three or four Republican senators who have COVID. And I'm not sure that they can vote remotely. Do they have enough time to get her confirmation done prior to the election, do you think?
I think so. But of course, the Democrats will try to delay things as much as they can. They will use whatever process and procedural obstacles are available to them to slow things down. They will try to do that. There's no question about it, because they feel that this is not the appropriate thing to do at this time. They will also make that claim at the hearings, which start tomorrow, that, you know, this is being rushed through. There's a real crisis in the country, and the real crisis is how to deal with the pandemic. Why are we trying to rush through a judicial appointment when Americans are suffering both medically and economically and psychologically? Why is that? Why is rushing a judge through more important than dealing with American, you know, the daily problems that Americans face? So they'll make that case. But I think the Senate now, certainly on issues of judicial nomination, the process is fully in the hands of the majority, and the majority can just ram things through if it wishes to do so. Yes, there are committee hearings that will be held. I think they'll be held for 3 days this week, I believe, starting tomorrow. But ultimately, the majority leader, the majority party, can yank things out of the hands of a committee if it so wishes. And if it decides to yank things out, if things are being drawn out in the committee, or if it wants to yank it out for whatever reason, it can put it on the floor pretty readily. So, yes, there is enough time. We'll have to see how it plays out. What's interesting is whether it will benefit. I mean, clearly, for the Republican side, there are two issues here. One is they do want a conservative Supreme Court. That is a goal of the party, has been a longstanding goal of the party. But there's also the short-term goal of winning the election, winning the presidential election. It's not clear to me whether the Barrett nomination will help the Republicans in that sense, that is to say, winning the election. Because in politics, for every action, there is a reaction, just like in
action.
And it's quite clear that the Barrett nomination has activated Republicans, very clearly so. But it also has activated Democrats just as clearly so. So it's not clear to me that it will necessarily be a net benefit for the Republican Party on the electoral, in the electoral cycle.
Professor, well, you know, that's exactly the, excuse me, Maria, that's exactly the way I've looked at it, Professor. I mean, as a campaign person, that's what I would say to him. Aren't you playing to your base again and ignoring the fact that more than 60% of the people recently polled are against pushing the nomination through? I mean, don't you think he would gain more by backing off at this point than and saying, let's wait till after the election. Don't you think politically you could gain more by doing that?
Well, yes. I mean, there are many things that the president could have done that, that would have benefited him politically. I mean, if he had really taken charge, for instance, of the pandemic and really right. taken charge of it and tried to deal with it scientifically, medically, and trying to help people both on the scientific end, but also on the economic end, instead of, you know, trying to divide the country over it and trying to hide various elements of it, as have come out in the news, he would have been unbeatable. I mean, if he had taken charge wow. of the crisis, one of the things that is standard political science, if there is a crisis, if there is a problem, and you take charge of it as president, and you really go forward and try to do the best that you can to solve the problem, even if you err a little bit, even if you make mistakes, the people will back you. They will say you're the captain of the ship, and you're our best hope for success. And so they will back the president. If he had really taken charge of this thing, he would have been unbeatable. Instead, he did not. And as a consequence, he's feeling the fallout, and the Republican Party is feeling the fallout. So, you know, that's part of his problem. I don't think he's understood the dynamics of the political process. I mean, you can see that, you know, when George W. Bush faced that crisis of the World Trade Center and the 9/11 attack, you know, in Washington, in New York, and in Pennsylvania, he was a little hesitant at first. I think we all saw that. But then he understood. Either he understood or he was advised, you take charge of it. And as a result of that, his polling went up to 90% approval. If Donald Trump had done the same thing over the pandemic, I think he would have been in an unbeatable situation. But that's not what he chose to do.
Well, you know, we saw that when I worked on the Carter campaign in 80. The big issue for us was, of course, hostages in Iran. And we believed, at least in the campaign, if the hostages got out, that we would have been the victors. But, of course, we had that terrible raid where the plane went down and the Navy SEALs were killed. And it just looked like the president couldn't handle the situation. And that we really saw that as his ultimate demise was at that point.
Well, so. You know, that's all, you're right. And that's always the risk of taking charge and things go wrong. Either they go wrong because right. they haven't planned properly or, you know, things just happen that make things go wrong. But on the same point that I'm making, there are two instances where presidents did not take charge in addition to the Trump behavior here, which showed that it didn't help the president. In fact, it hurt them. And that was the hurricane problem that, I forget the name of the hurricane, but during
Katrina.
The Bush administration.
Katrina.
That's right. Where New Orleans was basically devastated and the mm-hmm. president did not take charge of that. Mm-hmm. That was the start of his downfall because he didn't take charge of it and people thought that he should have. Okay. And that hurt him politically. For Obama, just to be bipartisan about it, he faced an environmental crisis when that oil rig, that pipeline mm-hmm. in the Gulf of Mexico blew up, and he basically didn't take charge of it and let it happen and didn't give the impression that he was on top of it and watching it and doing everything he could to try and bring it under control. That hurt Obama politically, too. So the lessons really is when a crisis erupts, whether it's a big crisis or a small crisis, you try to take charge of it and give the impression that you are taking charge of it. If you don't, you run political risks and political setback.
I would like to ask you, Professor, as we close in on our time, and thank you again for being our guest today. If somebody's listening and they're still on the fence because of one reason or another, what would your advice be for them to consider before they actually cast their vote about the president of the United States?
Well, I would say two things because those are really the two things that count the most. Okay, first, what policies do you support and do you believe in will be good for the country? Where do you want to see the country 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What's your vision of America down the road? And therefore, what policies do you believe are the correct ones for this country? Secondly, and that has to do with political comportment and political temperament, which is true for every president. Okay, we speak a lot about that with Donald Trump, but it's true for every president. Understand that the president has the power to so-called the button on nuclear arms. The president has the power to commit U.S. troops to combat, and ultimately use the ultimate weapon that this country possesses, which is atomic and thermonuclear weaponry. Who do you believe will hold and wield that power well, seriously, and thoughtfully? That's true for every president. And understand one thing, which many people don't really absorb fully. The president is the top general of this country. He outranks every general of this country's military. So who do you believe will wield that power? Because there's nobody who can overrule him. Who do you believe will rule, use that power properly? And that has to do with temperament, judgment, experience. And so that's the second component, policy, and then judgment of the, and then thinking about the judgment powers and the judgment capacities and, of the president.
Thank you.
Well, to your second point, Professor, I just heard a commentator make this point, and it wasn't something that I thought about, but, you know, when the president was at Walter Reed, his doctors worked for him. They said, you know, it's such an unusual situation because all the doctors are Navy doctors and he's commander in chief. You know, normally your doctor isn't someone who's your subordinate. And I think we've seen with their reluctance to release information and, you know, their kind of go along attitude that he has used his power to push them in that direction. And I think that's a very poignant thing to consider. And I think we've seen him fail at that. I really do. Maria, I'm going to give you the last word because you're a good Republican. And I know you have some comment. Go ahead.
Well, Professor, I want to thank you for this informed and wise conversation, because I think that you've maybe added some nuances to topics that we haven't really explored before on our program. So thank you for your wisdom. And then also to your point about, I am a Republican. I've been registered Republican since I was 18 years of age, and this will be the first time that I'm voting for a Democrat for president. And we don't, the Senator and I don't get very partisan on our program because we try and give everybody their voice. But what do you have to say to people about the politics of what's going on, calling Kamala a monster and a communist, and I mean, just doing things that are seem not only unpresidential but unstatesmanlike, unseemly?
Yeah, well, that certainly is true, and that's been unfortunately something the president has done since the beginning of his administration, demonizing people who he disagrees with, including people who once worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's one thing to attack your opponents, but then to demonize also people who once worked for you and now don't, is, or for whatever reason, is another element of his judgment and his personality. And that's been a problem for the president throughout his administration. And I think now he faces the problem now with an election in view. And I think he understands, or at least the people around him understands, that the polling, now I don't know whether that will play out in election time, but at least the political situation that is registering now is one in which he's losing. Okay. And what we see with the president is every time he feels that he's losing, he lashes out all the more.
Yes.
He makes those crazy statements about Senator Harris, which are just crazy, quite frankly, and have no relationship to reality, what she believes, what she says, what she has voted on, and what she says she will do if elected vice president. He is, I think those statements are an indication that at least he feels in a rather desperate situation at this moment. We'll have to see whether it plays out on election day, and who actually wins that election. But right now, he knows he's in a losing position.
Thank you.
Well, you know what? I agree 100% with Maria. This has been a fascinating and enlightening conversation, Professor. Thank you so much for being with us. I regret that I never had a chance to take a course in political science from you since I was
too.
A political science major. But if you decide to run for something, please let me know, because I'll make a first contribution to your campaign. And I hope you can come back maybe after the election, and we can, because I have 1,000 more questions for you. You've really been a great guest. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Marie, and thank you, Senator. It's really great to speak with you. It's been a pleasure for me, and I'm always happy to speak with you again. So I look forward to another opportunity.
Thank you.
All right. You all take care, you and the people who work with you. You all take care, and, of course, stay safe and stay healthy.
Exactly, and continued success.
Thank you so much. The same with you. Yes, and we always play a song at the end of the show, and this goes out to Vice President Pence and Senator Harris. This is Dave Mason with We Just Disagree.
Give the people their right to vote.